40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, the city of New Westminster aims to eliminate all traffic deaths and injuries through a new Vision Zero task force. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby tells us more. Couples who receive disability assistance will now be able to be with loved ones without having to worry about reduced support clawbacks. According to an announcement from the BC Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, Sheila Malcolmson, Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo has more. And Town of Smithers Councillor Frank Ray is hoping that the Union of BC Municipalities will finally allow time to address all proposed resolutions brought forward by communities after more than 50 resolutions went undebated during September's convention. Pam Hassan at CICK News in Smithers dives in. I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The city of New Westminster is aiming to fully eliminate all traffic-related deaths and injuries, and they plan to achieve this through the recently launched Vision Zero Task Force. According to the city's press release regarding the task force, quote, "The goal is to design a transportation network that anticipates human error and prevents it from leading to tragedy," end quote. Vision Zero is still in its preliminary stages, so CJSF reached out to the City of New Westminster to learn more about what the task force entails and what it plans to deliver. We sat down for a conversation with New Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone, who is helping lead the Vision Zero task force. During our conversation, we spoke about other cities that have adopted a Vision Zero philosophy, some of the city departments involved, and what the task force aims to accomplish. Please take a listen.
Okay, well, New Westminster has made a commitment to making our roads safer, and making roads safer especially for vulnerable road users. And we've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of years on mostly engineering investments in order to build safer intersections and to address some safety issues we identified in our road network. But Vision Zero is a different approach, which is popular in North America as a marketing term, but popular in Europe as an actual change in mindset about how we actually manage road safety. And I want New Westminster to take that second sort of more European approach and talk about road safety as a systems failure or a systems problem, as opposed to just a marketing program around different engineering or different enforcement opportunities. So my inspiration came from, of all places, Hoboken, New Jersey, which is a city remarkably similar to New Westminster, an older, dense city next to a much larger city, post-industrial on the river. But they have had they really embraced more than I think any city in North America, a Vision Zero mindset, and have had no road deaths in many years, in over 7 years now, in the city of Hoboken. And they have, and I met the mayor of Hoboken, New Jersey, and I asked him, you know, how did that happen? And he said, simple, we just fixed the roads. And I said, well, it's not that simple. So and so in British Columbia, we have a different jurisdiction here. We have jurisdictional overlap. We have the Ministry of Transportation, we have TransLink, we have ICBC. We have different agencies that have control over our roads. And I thought the first step in a Vision Zero approach is to actually understand the data, actually understand who is collecting what data around road safety, who is doing what work over roads around road safety. And so the first step in our Vision Zero journey in New Westminster is to bring those partners together on a task force. And we had our first meeting last week, and we sat down and talked about, now, who does what when a road incident happens? Whose role is where? Who is collecting what data? And who is able to share that data with everyone else around this table so that we can work together on creating a creative or an innovative approach to addressing road safety locations in the city after incidents happen.
I mean, that relates to another question I had, which was I noticed in like the sort of press information regarding the Vision Zero Task Force, there was talk about wanting to adopt a Vision Zero philosophy that has been adopted in other cities and has been proven successful. And you mentioned New Jersey, specifically that Hoboken, New Jersey.
Yes, the home of Frank Sinatra, but that's another.
adopting a similar philosophy. And, you know, I think a lot of times when people think of road or vehicle accidents or road or vehicle deaths, it is upsetting to say, but it almost feels like an inevitability in a lot of people's minds. How, I guess, do you want the Vision Zero Task Force to sort of combat that narrative of just the roads being the way they are?
Right. As a philosophy at the center, Vision Zero is overturns that idea, overturns the idea that deaths and serious injuries related to road use are inevitable and something we have to accept as part of the economy of moving around. We have to change that mindset. We have to change the culture to say that that's acceptable. We have to start by accepting the idea that that deaths and serious injuries are not a necessary part of transportation. And there are cities around the world that have demonstrated that. I mentioned Hoboken. Helsinki is another city that has embraced this, and they simply did not have a road death in Helsinki last year. That's a city of over 1 million people in the metro area, and they did not have a road death last year. Like, it is, it's doable, but we do have to change the philosophy. And it goes all the way down to even talking about the language. We don't use the word accident when we talk about road incidents. There are no accidents when it comes to the road. They are preventable and identifiable causes to road deaths and to serious injury. And just the using the word accident, it gives the idea that it's inevitable, it's unavoidable, it's something that no one could have foreseen coming, when actually there are processes to identify incidents that are likely to cause death and injury, and we can address those issues. And I think we can relate it to a couple of different things. We can relate it to aircraft safety. When an airplane crashes, things happen. Right? When people die in an aircraft crash, whether it's a small aircraft or a large aircraft, there are people who find out what caused that incident. And even if it's pilot error, even if it's mechanical error, even if it's weather, there are recommendations that come forward to how are we going to stop that happening again in the future. We don't accept that people have to die for there to be planes flying around the world. Another example is workplace safety. 100 years ago, when people were dying or being seriously injured on the job, it was a presumption that it was just careless workers and there's nothing we can do about that. That's the cost of coal mining, or that's the cost of running a manufacturing plant, or that's the cost of a retail store. We don't accept that anymore. Through WorkSafe and through workplace safety, we have identified measures in place, and we put measures in place so that people are safe on the job. And it comes down to what we like to call an accident is almost always someone made a mistake in an unsafe environment. And people make mistakes all the time. People make mistakes when flying their airplane. People make mistakes at work. People make mistakes when they're driving their car. But what we have to do is remove the part of where that just making a mistake results in a serious injury or a death. We've done that in the workplace. We do that with everything from steel-toe boots to safe approach distances to creating, we've done a lot of work to make workplaces safe and recognize when someone is killed in a workplace incident that there were decisions that were made around putting them in that unsafe place. We don't do that so much on the roads. You know, we're very reactive in the roads on roads, and we accept the fact that people make mistakes when they're driving and sometimes people die because of that. Well, yes, people make mistakes when driving. Let's not accept that people die because of that. Let's build safer roads. Let's build safer vehicles. Let's build safer practices so that serious injury and death is not an accepted part of our roads.
Who are some of the people involved within the task force? I noticed in the press video there were, you know, city staff, but then also people from Vision Zero Vancouver as well as Movement in that video. And I'm wondering how the layout of the task force was formulated.
So those advocates from the community are not part of the task force in our first phase, but they did come in. Like, we have talked to those advocates about Vision Zero and recognize there will be a second phase of this work in the city where we do bring the activists and the community in to talk about what they see and what they experience and what the city should be doing differently. But this first phase is actually really a bit of a technical work. It's a little bit boring technical work. But we have the city's engineering teams. We have first responders, fire and police, who respond to incidents that happen on the road. We have the Ministry of Transportation's road safety group in there. And we have public health. We have people from injury prevention in work in public health. And it's interesting, they all have a different take into how they interact with road safety. The public health has a mandate to reduce accidents and reduce deaths and serious injuries from accidents. And driving is only one part of that. But they identify accident trends, injury trends, death trends. But they don't necessarily share that information proactively with the communities where those incidents are taking place. And so we can't, as a city, necessarily react to trends that are coming out of that because we're not given that data. Ministry of Transportation, much the same things. They address road safety on the roads that they have a mandate over. But they don't necessarily share those with the city. The one piece missing, we've invited them to take part in this, and I'm still hoping they will take an active part of this, is ICBC. ICBC collects the most road safety data of anyone in the province. But the road safety data they collect isn't necessarily designed to address road design or think causative factors around road design. It's more around collecting data to determine fault, to determine what happened so that we can understand whether there was any criminal activity that took place that resulting in an incident. Drinking and driving being an obvious example. They want to collect data. If the person was drinking and driving before they had the incident, that's a criminal act that led to it. But they don't necessarily give us the information we need right now or collect the information we need right now to understand trends around unsafe areas in the city, what the causative factors around road angles and lighting patterns and those types of things were. And more importantly, ICBC isn't really fast at turning the data back over to us. We do use ICBC crash data to prioritize road improvements in New Westminster, but it's almost always, you know, 2 or 3 years old crash data, and it doesn't necessarily break down that data in between the different road users so that in a way that we can actually proactively design around that. So I think they need to come to the table. And all that to say, to answer your question, at the first phase, it's a very technical task force talking about the data that we collect and how people interact with road incidents, with the goal that they will create some recommendations about first steps that the city can do around better data sharing and also about advocacy to the provincial government around regulatory changes or legislative changes or things that the provincial government can do to help us as a partner in making roads safer. I think after this first phase does those first recommendations, that's when we'll bring in a broader representation of the community. Because I don't want to talk about an intersection. I don't want to talk about, I can look out my window right now and see 6th and Royal and think about things that can make that intersection safer. Our staff are constantly doing that type of engineering work. I think the Vision Zero approach is something different. It's looking at the bigger systems. And when we have a better understanding of how we can adjust those systems and what priorities we take to changing those systems, that will trickle down to better advice about what we can do about Sixth and Royal, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that ties into the next question I had, which was just, say, 2-3 years from now, when the Vision Zero Task Force is kind of established, all of what it's wanted to achieve, what are some of those key deliverables? Like, how do you see the just road infrastructure of New West shifting to not accommodate, but to represent what Vision Zero is about?
Yeah, I think that we will see our prioritization of our investment in road safety shifting and being more data-driven and being more informed by what the actual unsafe situations are out there, instead of being reactive to 3-year-old crash data when it comes to prioritizing that work, or being reactive to a person who comes to council and says, this intersection in front of my house isn't safe. We have to hear those voices. We have to hear from those folks. But that's not necessarily, like before I spend $1 million putting a signal light treatment into an intersection, I don't want just one person in the community to say that intersection is not safe. I want to actually understand that investment isn't being better spent, $1 million somewhere else, making an intersection that's actually more less safe better. The other side of that is really, I think, some of that legislation and regulatory change we need. I think that it's difficult in British Columbia for governments to share data. It's just a matter of sort of how the bureaucracy of our different levels of government work. And I think that if we could have some legislative or regulatory change to make it easier for us to share that data in a creative way and in a proactive way. And so that, you know, I sat down last week or a week and a half ago with a person in this community who had been struck by a vehicle while they were riding their bicycle and had life-altering injuries. And they felt that the road wasn't safe, that they were not served by the cycle routes that were provided by them to them in the city. And they felt that put them a little bit in danger. They also felt that the police didn't react quickly enough to address the hit and run or to find the person who did the hit and run who injured them. They also feel they've been let down by ICBC because they're stuck in a no-fault insurance situation which treats them as a liability, not as a person who needs support. So there's a lot of systems around this that I think are failing this person. But one piece of that is that my engineering staff in the city didn't know that crash had happened. They did not know this person had been hit by a car on that intersection, had been hit and run. There is no process to get that data back to our engineering staff so they can go out to that site and look at it and say, oh, can we make engineering changes here to make this intersection safer? It's very ad hoc how our engineering department finds out about incidents that happen in the city. So we can't even make those, we can't be proactive as we'd like to be in addressing engineering changes without that information.
Mm-hmm. Is the Vision Zero Task Force something that all of New West Council has some sort of involvement with, or just certain members?
Yeah, right now in the task force, I'm the chair of the task force, and Councillor Fontaine, one of the other members of council, is on there as a council representative.
Okay.
But again, it's mostly a technical body at this point. There'll be an interesting conversation. I think all of council endorsed the idea of doing this path, Vision Zero and us going down this pathway towards creating a technical task force and then expanding it in a second phase to include a bigger community conversation. So I think everybody on council is concerned about road safety and is concerned about making especially vulnerable road users safe in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, that was our conversation with New Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone on the recently launched Vision Zero Task Force. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is a CHY News update. Couples who receive disability assistance will now be able to be with the ones they love without having to worry about reduced support clawbacks. Starting December 1st of this year, couples where both members receive disability assistance will receive the same support allowance as they would if they were two single people. On Thursday, November 13th, the government of BC announced it would become the first province in the country to get rid of the spousal clawback. Currently, if two people on disability assistance enters into a relationship, their combined supports would be reduced to be less than what they receive as two single people. CHY was at the announcement when MLA for Nanaimo and Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, Sheila Malcolmson, announced the change. Malcolm says the clawbacks have been an ongoing concern for people with disabilities, as it means people would lose financial support simply for choosing to live with somebody that they love.
We want people to have the supports that they need to live with dignity and independence, both financial supports and the supports that they have in a loving relationship.
The changes would be automatic for eligible families and no application is needed.
This will take effect with the next check issue, which is November 19. Also, couples where one partner is receiving disability assistance will also benefit from an increase in the annual earnings exemption, allowing them to keep more of the money that they earn.
Julie Black and James Chapman will be celebrating 5 years of marriage next year, after knowing each other for over 14 years. Black says this new announcement is a big deal for couples like her and her husband, who have been impacted by the clawbacks.
It was a month-to-month thing where we had to find a way to scrounge for money every month just to be able to make a living. And we both work, but it doesn't pay enough for the bills, especially with the inflation now.
She says that with the ending of the clawbacks, she can now live like a normal person without having to worry about whether or not they have enough money each month. Black says people have been advocating for this change for a while, and it's great to see that work has made such a difference.
They've been pushing for this for, oh my gosh, for years since I've been married. And now that it's happening, we don't have to hide anymore. Before, we felt that we had to hide the relationship like any other relationship with diverse abilities. A lot of people feel they had to hide the relationship because the ministry would pull that money back. And now we don't have to worry about that. So that's a big deal.
The changes fulfill the commitments made by the BC-NDP in their 2024 election platform and their cooperation and responsible government accord with the BC Green Party. For CH1 News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News.
A growing number of exotic pet owners across British Columbia are urging their communities to speak out against UBCM Resolution NR75, which calls on the provincial government to strengthen regulations around mobile live animal programs and the keeping and breeding of exotic species. Critics say the proposal could make owning reptiles, amphibians, and other non-traditional pets illegal, affecting responsible hobbyists, educators, and conservation programs. They worry it would also shut down mobile educational programs that connect people with animals and promote wildlife conservation. Supporters of exotic pet ownership argue that NR75 could drive responsible care underground, harming both animals and the people who care for them. While this may seem a bit niche for our northern listeners, Smithers Town Council did receive a letter from a concerned citizen, and I was able to connect with Councillor and Deputy Mayor Frank Ray about how councillors vote at UBCM, and a little bit about this resolution. I'm also speaking with a passionate exotic animal rescuer who thinks that education and access to exotic animals can change people's perceptions on exotic animals.
Hi, I'm Councillor Frank Ray with the Town of Smithers.
So I reached out to you to actually speak about a resolution that I saw in a letter to council at the UBCM, but before we were recording, you were bringing me up to speed on a little bit about how there wasn't time to actually get to it. And that was almost like, it's almost like in the only 2/3 of the way in for all the resolutions. So can you talk a little bit about how maybe the debate was approached a little bit differently at UBCM?
So it's actually going to change next year. Early on in the resolutions, we had a resolution to change how we're dealing with resolutions going forward, which would mean that we should be able to get through all of the resolutions more quickly and with time for debate. So this year, the one we're talking about was NR75, no recommendation block, which is really where we really do have a debate about whether or not a certain thing is going to become UBCM policy. And so we stopped this year at NR67, and there were 125 NRs. Most years we don't get through, so I'm hoping that this change that we've made this year will give more positive results next year.
What is the change?
What we have, an endorsed block, which is already UBCM policy, so we can pull resolutions out of there and debate them. But the change going forward is if it's been endorsed before and it's very similar, it's not going to be admitted for debate. It's just going to be to inform what we're already advocating for at UBCM. And then there are ones that they come up a couple of years in a row and they get voted down. If it's been voted down recently, then it doesn't get admitted again if it comes back up. So the UBCM executive is going to really parse through them, and then only ones that are really matters that we haven't considered before or aren't already things we're advocating for will get debated.
And the one that we're talking about, which is mobile live animal programs, it is a strange thing that I saw a letter written to council about. So what's your take from council about how this is applicable to Smithers, if you feel like it is at all?
When people write letters to council doesn't actually decide as a council how to vote on these matters. Every individual that goes as a delegate has their own vote. So it is really up to the conscience of the individual councillors and mayors that go to UBCM to vote on these things.
We were speaking about how NR75 is actually more like two resolutions.
They are two different asks, but because they're related, it's a therefore be it resolved and be it further resolved. And so basically it's asking them to regulate the animal programs and then also to update the controlled alien species regulation to take a little more into effect about how the animals themselves are treated and the risks of disease transmission, et cetera. So I think it's a little bit of looking at maybe updating some acts to be more not just human-centered, I think. I forgot to mention is that the second whereas actually asked them to prohibit the import, keeping, breeding, and transport of all exotic species, which is fairly wide-ranging. So I could see where perhaps some people might have concerns with that.
Yeah, Councillor Ray, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks again to Smithers Town Councillor Frank Ray for speaking to me.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
Bird Note. Birder and author Christian Cooper says listening to birds helped him unlock a kind of superpower.
It's very exciting because it's like you have a sixth sense that most people don't have. You know, I'm walking through a park on my way to the gym. I am not looking or paying attention to birds, except I am, because I always am. And my ears are telling me, oh, the white-throated sparrows are back just from hearing their call notes.
Christian says sound mnemonics are a great way to learn bird calls. Some birds have well-known mnemonics, like the oh, sweet Canada, Canada, Canada of the white-throated sparrow. But you can also make up your own.
One of the things I really love doing is making the connections, like I call the blue jay the Rihanna bird, because Rihanna has a song, Shut Up and Drive, where one of the parts of the song is where she goes, so if you want me, let me know, no, no. And I hear that, and I'm like, well, that's the same thing a blue jay does with its call. It's not just a flat sound, it drops at the end. So it's going, yang, yang, yang.
Looking for more tips on birding by ear? Start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 292. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a project that is called Crying Glacier. This is really a moving work that experiments between sound art and climate change. This looks at the